Hey everybody, Jan Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership and my good buddy, my former boss, my good friend, somebody I admire greatly, Tim Cole with the Compass Alliance. Hello, Tim.
Hey, Jan, how are you? Thank you.
I'm good. We are live. We are live on LinkedIn. We're live on YouTube and live on Facebook. So we got to be good. We got to be good today. You ready? So what we're going to talk about is we're going to talk about this crazy year, 2020. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what we observe from a leadership and team perspective that might be different than years past. And based on that, what the implications might be for 2021. I think like me, it's been interesting in that neither of us have really been on a plane the entire year, which is really unusual. And all our clients have been experiencing the same thing. So as we get to work with people, varied people, we're kind of working on the same issues and problems with them. So I thought it might be really interesting to get your insight and to share that with the people viewing.
I think that's a good start. And you're right. Wow. Who will ever be able to get 2020 out of their minds? I was reading an article the other day, Jan, that said the World Economic Forum estimates the cost of the pandemic to the global economy is going to be something like $1 trillion, which is an amazing figure. And I think the simple fact that you and I are having a conversation around this is powerful. One of the things I encourage our clients with the Compass Alliance to consider is, have you actually paused to reflect on the insights or the potential insights from 2020? And if you have, how is that going to inform your actions moving forward? So taking the time to stop and slow down and ask, what have we learned from this, I think is powerful. In answer to your question, there's so many things we could talk about. I'll offer three that come to mind immediately. And first, from a leadership standpoint, a lot of companies talk about crisis or adversity leadership, but it's only when crisis or adversity hits that they begin to really appreciate what it's all about. I see a lot of organizations that are really stopping and taking stock of what's the percentage of transformative leaders they have versus the percentage of transactional managers. In the main, most companies have a lot of the latter and very few of the former, but they're only now finding out what the difference in the two happen to be. So that's one thing. On the individual level, you and I have talked about this. When this COVID thing broke in February and March, I talked to a lot of people that said, you know, Tim, I think I'm more productive now than I was before in terms of going into an office. And that's changed dramatically in the last 3 months. I see a lot of people who are, if not teetering on being out of balance, are already there. And so thinking about how we navigate this incredible time, how we balance our lives, time, energy management, whatever you call it, I think has become pretty big in a lot of people's minds individually. And then the third piece, and I'll stop, is that organizationally, the biggest thing I'm seeing now is a lot of companies have aspirations to be flexible, to be agile, to be responsive. But what we found is that a lot of companies, when they think about strategy and strategic execution, don't spend a lot of time investing in contingency planning or catastrophic planning. And so this has forced organizations to really look at, what is our strategy? What's our planning processes? And finally, when we execute, have we really factored what happens when things go terribly wrong? It's like the great philosopher Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get hit in the mouth. A lot of companies have been hit in the mouth, and they, frankly, they're still on the canvas trying to figure out how they get up. And what's more, trying to figure out how they'll get up if this happens again.
Yeah. You mentioned strategy. What I've seen, you know, part of what I've seen is, a lot of people at the beginning said, hey, this is interesting, you know, an interesting leadership challenge. And they sort of embraced it. And then it kind of got old quick. And then we entered what I call the trough of despair, you know, where people are really dealing with a lot of things, a lot of mental health issues, a lot of different things. And the comments I've heard is, gosh, I don't really recognize my culture anymore. Mm. And so, you know, as you and I both know, when you create strategy, you also have to intentionally create a culture that supports that strategy. And I think given our Zoom world these days, we haven't really thought about that. We've just thought, gosh, I've got to produce X amount and deliver these numbers. That's how I keep people employed. So I've got to push them, but I don't want to break them. And then you've got employees over here that are saying, please be compassionate. I'm at my limit. Don't ask me to do too much, but I still want to have a job. And meanwhile, everybody's sort of tiptoeing around not having difficult conversations. And there's no values and standards being upheld by teams and leaders. And so you're seeing things sort of get loosey-goosey and fall apart a little bit. And, you know, I think it manifests itself in a sense of belonging and isolation. And what I think is a leadership responsibility that's sort of fallen by the wayside.
I think you make some excellent points. You know, you talk about values and vision. We found out which companies walk the talk and which companies talk the talk. And a lot of times there are a lot of people that are capable of saying the words, but in times of crisis, you find out. It's the old saying, I'll read what's on the walls, but I'll believe what I see in the halls. Mm-hmm. And the virtual halls today are crowded with companies that kind of have, and to a certain degree, they've panicked. I don't think strategy and culture are on opposite ends of the spectrum. I think you're right. You consciously create a strategy, but you also have to consciously create a culture that embraces all the aspects of strategy. And at the very core culture, in my opinion, is this sometimes very vague term called human capital. The greatest resource any of us has is human capital. And frankly, if you allow that to slip into the background, you're going to have problems down the line. So I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've seen a lot of different companies up close and personal, and some have done well and some haven't. What's some success stories that you can point to, or things that you've observed that has sort of exceeded expectations, if you will?
Yeah, I think the companies that have done it best have deliberately built something that you referenced earlier. They recognized early on, when this thing began to break on us, this thing being COVID, that they needed to wrap for lack of a better term, a warm blanket around their employees. And they did some very sophisticated things to say to the organization, hey, we don't have all the answers, but we're going to make sure that your health and well-being is top of mind. And so they're, whether that's through portals or communication devices, they said, we're going to do everything we can to take care of you first and then the business. And I think that was very powerful. And then the other thing that I see is, and again, this is such a litmus test for leaders, I'm not sure you can over-communicate in times of crisis. The people, the organizations, the individual leaders that I think have really prospered during this very difficult time have embraced the notion that one of the most powerful coins of the realm in crisis is communication. And not just one way, it two way. What do you think? This is what I think. How can we survive together? And eventually, how can we thrive? Those are two things that come to mind immediately.
Yeah. And what about on the other side? What have you seen people do poorly? Is it just the opposite of what you've seen, or is it something different?
Well, I want to be careful in saying what I see people do poorly, but there are a lot of companies that I think were caught so flat-footed by the crisis that they immediately went to catch-up mode. And here's a classic example. You know, technology is at the core of so much of the recovery efforts. There are some companies that were all over artificial technology, platforms, technology, and they were prepared for possibilities of, for instance, remote work. If you didn't have a plan, it was Katie bar the door, run for the hills. So I think it goes back to what we said earlier. I always ask when I talk with leaders around strategy, and you know, we always break it down: strategic thinking, strategic planning, strategic execution. But when we look at strategy, I always try to ask the question, what are your contingency plans? Mm. If everything goes south, what are you going to do? And the reason I do that, Jan, and even before I met you in the early 80s, I remember the Johnson & Johnson crisis with Tylenol. You were probably in the military then, but I learned something from that. Johnson & Johnson did an amazing job of responding to a crisis that wasn't of their making. And they did that because they had a leader at the time that said, whatever the situation, we're accountable for it and we're going to fix it. And they were able to respond. And any movement in times of crisis, I think, can be powerful. It's the companies that get bogged down, inertia, and then they begin to worry. And it's like, my gosh, you used the term trough of despair. I think in our personal lives, if you're not moving in some way, it's easy to fall into the trough.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. And I do remember the Tylenol, and it was a masterclass in what they did from a PR perspective.
Yes.
And taking ownership. So much of what organizations are doing right now have to do with, you know, demonstrating compassion and at the same time doing this strategic planning. And one of the things I ask always when I'm helping people with strategic planning is, let's fast forward 6 to 12 months from now. Why did you fail? Why'd you fail? And they kind of do this blank look, and I'm like, no, why might this fail? And then let's button up those things. Mm-hmm. And it's something I learned from Chris Payton over in England. He was a Royal Marine, and he calls it, you know, pressure testing things. And I think, you know, that's an important consideration. The other thing is I'm seeing, as much as we measure and manage everything these days, or at least like we feel like we do, I think there's a lot of things that we really have no idea what's going on. And oftentimes, I'll hear a lot of complaints about balance and boundaries. You know, my life's out of balance. I'm working crazy hours. I'd really like to set up some boundaries to have some time to think, to plan, to execute. But most people don't know exactly where they even spend their time.
Yeah.
They might know where they spend money, the organization spend money and budgets, but most people have no idea where they spend their time. And it sort of boggles me that one of the simplest things to do is to look at the calendar over the past 90 days and put it into buckets and categories and create yourself a little pie chart. You know, this is how much time I spent on admin or strategy or execution or people development. And 99% of the time people will say, I want to spend more time on developing my people, on one-to-one. And yet we're caught up in all these meetings. And that's the other thing is I think, you know, meetings are still run very poorly. I mean, I sent a picture out the other day on LinkedIn, and I had a picture of a meeting in 1950 and a meeting in 2020. And the only difference I thought was 1950, there was an ashtray on the table. And in 2020, there was computers on the table. Other than that, I bet the meeting is run exactly the same way. It's tons of wasted time and no clarity with regard to how a decision is going to be made, who has the authority, what the process is, what the criteria is. Because, you know, most meetings should be decision-making meetings. You know, otherwise, you know, you can read stuff. You don't need meetings to just be information. So are you seeing some of those fundamental things that we've missed for decades now? And are they exacerbated in this remote environment? And is it, you know, a lot of these things that you talk about, I mean, which sounds so much like fundamentals, is that what we're kind of missing? We're enamored with all the fancy technology and different things and sort of missing the rudiments?
I think we're drunk with busyness, B-U-S-Y-N-E-S-S, and it's an intoxicating ailment, and it's compromising at the individual level. The biggest single thing I see, because so many of us now live, quote unquote, over the company store. Mm-hmm. By that I mean that darn computer is always linked and you can't get away from it. And because we love being busy, we do things. We all have the same amount of minutes per day, 1,440. And you're right. Part of it is can do and part of it is will do. But I've learned that the most productive people really understand how to manage their time, and they treat it as they should, as the only non-renewable resource at their disposal. You don't get more time. I don't care if you're Jeff Bezos or the guy that is sweeping the sidewalk. And, you know, it's funny, when I study the leaders I think that are most effective, Jeff Bezos comes to mind. He spends one day each quarter thinking, thinking, is our strategy right? Have we considered contingencies? What's working? What's not? And I think that's very powerful. And time management is one of the great black holes that's threatening a lot of people. We do executive coaching and we do workshops on time and energy management. And personally, I think if we don't get our hands around this, it's going to get to crisis proportions because of what you just said. People are a little bit emotionally on edge and it's getting worse rather than better. So I'd say yes, definitely. I would also say you said something about measures. It's amazing how often we measure things that offer limited return and fail to measure the things that are greatest return. There's a strong body of evidence out there that says 80% of most executives spend a majority of their time on things that render 20% of corporate value. And one of the things that you and I are doing right now that I think is incredibly powerful and oftentimes overlooked, whether you call it an after action review or a pressure wash or whatever you call it, a life or a career or a business that's unexamined, that doesn't take the time to say, what happened? What have we learned? What worked and what didn't? And what are we going to do differently moving forward is so very powerful. But unfortunately, people are so, again, intoxicated with doing something, they never take the time to look back. And that can, especially in the wake of a pandemic, that can kill you. Because in 2024, if it happens again, if people do the same darn thing, we will have learned nothing.
There's a great video, a 90-second video out there with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. And they're teasing Warren Buffett about his little paper calendar that has nothing in it. And he goes on to make the point that he's like, I can buy anything I want in the world, except I can't buy time.
That's right.
And, you know, it, the busier you get, the more important you get, the more people are pulling on you and grabbing. And like you said, the famous, hey, do you have 5 minutes?
Yeah. Well, you know, I tell you, the most important part of strategy, you know, this is the capacity and the willingness to say no. And it's hard because most of us are achievers. It's the no, for every yes we make, there is a no that we subconsciously give up. And saying no is tough because, again, we're all intoxicated with technology and staying busy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Some of the people we've got a podcast running now 4.5 years every single week. And we've invited a few people lately that have some really interesting books out there, and some people have graciously accepted. And a few people have said, you know what, I'm on fumes. They're like, I need a couple months off, circle back with me in February or March.
Yeah.
And you know what? I respect that. I respect the fact that somebody can say I'm up to here. Mm-hmm. And like you said, politely say no and not make an excuse for it. To just say, I can't take on more.
Yeah.
It is interesting, that we have so much trouble sort of sitting alone in our thoughts. We do an exercise on some of the Crucible expeditions where we ask people to sit alone by themselves for 3-4 hours and journal. And about a third of the people come back in big epiphany about what they thought about. A third of the people come back and said, I took a nap. I really struggled. I watched the bird. And about a third of the people cheat. They go find somebody else that can't do it, and they go and they talk.
Yeah.
they literally, and some of them came back and said, I didn't want to be alone in my thoughts. I didn't want to go there. Mm. And, it's interesting how we all go about those things. I rather do it during movement, exercise than just sitting. But I find if I don't take that time every day, things seem to pile on. Tim, let me ask you before we move on to what we think 2021 is about, as far as 2020, was there anything else that you saw this year that you didn't see in years past that surprised you or something that you learned from?
Well, I referenced earlier, and we have similar philosophies. I think that Well, first of all, I don't think I know. If you look at the average worker, whether that's U.S. or globally, long before COVID came, we had a pandemic called employee disengagement, and it was at near critical levels before COVID. So now that we've gone into this convoluted alternative dimension, it's probably much worse than it was before. And the one thing I've seen after, in my case, 41 years in industry, is that the one antidote, the one significant factor that can allay and in some cases remove employee disengagement is the impact of the manager, the leader, or leaders of an organization. I would tell you, if I could go back and whisper in the ear of clients or would-be clients, I would say, if you're not investing in building a core of transformative leaders, you better double down on it now, because when the wave hits, when the tsunami hits, you're going to be playing catch up, and that's going to potentially drown you. And the companies that I work with that I think that have invested there are probably far better positioned to speak to what you said, 2021, than the average company, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I know you hate when I pay you compliments, but you know, I often refer to you as the best boss I ever had. You know that. And sometimes, not very often, but sometimes people will say, why was he the best boss? And, you know, and I always go back and I say, well, you know, he took the time, you know, which a lot of managers don't do these days, is to sit down and really take time, not 15-minute checkup. But the other thing is, you always ask great questions. It was always about the other person. And so much of this pandemic has been about people checking in and being compassionate and knowing where their team is at in order to figure out, how do I push them to the next level and not break them? And again, if we don't know people and we don't care about them and know, you know, what their thoughts and desires and motivations, ambitions are, it's really hard to tap into any of that.
Yeah.
And again, if we do it from a selfish perspective, I mean, that's transparent. People are going to see that. So again, you know, it's kind of like it goes back to this time thing. I mean, we're talking about time to reflect and time to yourself. And again, if you're leading people, you're going to have to take time to invest in them. I mean, that has not changed over the decades. But again, with our busyness, with us being player coaches, we're not making those investments in people. I mean, part of what I think about the career I have now as an executive coach is, even, well, one, I couldn't have this career 30 years ago because the technology didn't exist. But the other thing is, 30 years ago, managers did what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of that's being outsourced to people like us. Like, I've got a problem with an executive, or I want you to bring them up. And, you know, part of it is, I think, you know, why isn't that happening from the top of the organization throughout, where we're really focused on what it takes to develop? And then all of a sudden we get to a spot and we're like, gosh, I don't have a succession plan. Mm-hmm. You know, now I need to bring in another consultant to work on succession.
Yeah. Well, you make a good point, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much. You're very kind to say that. But, you know, it's funny. I was in a conversation with someone who has interest in becoming a consultant recently, and I was reflecting on the conversation after. I got to tell you, one of the things I think, and I'd be interested to see if you agree with this, one of the wonderful things about the kind of work you do and the kind of work I do now is that, as opposed to when you're in the storm, you're trying to do what you just described, purposeful work, but you know, it's like being in a washing machine. When yeah. you do what we do, I'd like to think that at least 90% of the work I do today is actually purposeful and hopefully renders a return. And I always have a lot of compassion for the people that are in the washing machine, because it's easy for me to sit here and say, well, you need to spend more time thinking about this and reflecting on that. And then I remind myself, hey, dude, a couple of years ago, you were probably one of those people that was trying to keep your head above water just like they were. So I think you make a very, very, very good point. I appreciate your comments too.
Yeah. Well, let's look at 2021 and beyond. You know, I'm wondering what you think the implications are. I've got one that I think is pretty controversial, actually, but I want to hear what you think first. What do you think? What do you think, again, based on what we learned from this year going into next year, what are some implications for leaders and teams?
Well, and specifically to leaders and teams, we've just talked about a couple of things, but I think one of the things I would encourage companies to embrace is that though we know that there will be an after, the after is not going to be what it was before. And so regardless of the industry, I'm encouraging the people, at least that I work with, to embrace the fact that though we want it to return to what it was in 2019, those days are gone. And I encourage every company to do three things: to analyze what's happened, diagnose what the ramifications are, and then decide on what your treatment program is in your company for 2021 and beyond. Don't just assume that you go back to what was, because what was is gone. That's number one. And then number two, so much, whether it's strategy or really almost everything, comes back, in my opinion, to the quality of the leadership that you're developing, because human capital is born from great leaders. And what I'm encouraging companies to think about is, let's pressure test the leadership development that you have in place. Let's pressure test, by the way, the quality of the leaders. Which were the ones that prospered? Which were the ones that failed? What have you learned from that? And what are the competencies in the future world that you're going to have to embrace in order to be successful? Here's a classic example, and then I'll stop. I work with a lot of different companies, and across a fairly broad swath, I find that everyone talks, for instance, strategy. Strategy is like the throwaway word of the 21st century. But then when you delve into strategy and say, okay, how do you define strategy? And what is strategic thinking with your company? What is the planning processes that you have in place? And maybe most important, how do you execute against that strategy? What did 2020 teach you around those three things? And what are the adjustments that you're going to make? What I'm finding, and I will tell you, I see it borne out every day. There's data out there that says, Jan, that up to 90 to 95% of a typical company's employees have no idea of the strategy of their company.
Wow.
Now that's a start. That means if you and I fielded a football team, except for the left guard, nobody else on the team would have the faintest idea of what the play is or what the game is. But it happens every day, and we continue to invest in strategies that, frankly, oftentimes render very limited return because there's no alignment.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And now you know that we have remote, you know, workers, I think people are starting to feel a little bit like gig workers, even if they work in a company. You know, the thing I'm wondering about, and this is the controversial part, you know, you're seeing a lot of employees at Google, let's say, that are, you know, basically, you know, challenging management on various issues. And I'm wondering if there's going to be a sort of a rise up of white collar workers that create some sort of association or trade group or even quasi union to have more say so and power. Is, you know, because I think there's going to be certain offices that say we are an in-person environment, and certain offices that say you can work wherever you want, but if you don't work in California, we're going to lower your pay. I think there's going to be a whole bunch of pushback. You know, we know that B Corps are rising up, those that are socially and environmentally responsible. You know, the big business reason to go that route is, you know, besides, you know, if you feel it's the right thing to do, is it's about talent acquisition and retention. You know, that people want to work at organizations that are purpose driven. And so I'll throw that out there. I mean, what do you think of that? I mean, do you think that is a possibility? And again, what I see is the implications for leaders and teams are, boy, you know, people support what they help create. If you really want to keep your people engaged and not, you know, coming at you from all kinds of angles, then you've got to really be intentional about the strategy and the culture and the way that you engage employees.
Yeah, I think that you've just offered a couple things that, if we had the time, we should unpack. You know, here's what I don't know that we'll see an uprising of white collar workers, but I do know this: if you look at the workforce in just the United States, by 2025, 75% of that workforce will either be millennials or the next generation. And when we look at the data around that group, we know that purpose-driven work is escalating greatly versus my generation and arguably yours. Well, we're the same generation. I guess we can, I'll group you, even though you're younger than me, but
we're still boomers. Okay.
That's right. We're boomers. So I think whether we want to believe it or not, the future of work, going back to what we talked about around engagement, people will demand more. Workers will demand more. They'll want more autonomy. They'll want more purpose, and they'll want to know that what they do makes a difference. So yeah, I think that's certainly a possibility. And as regards the B Corps, I don't know. I haven't done a lot of work. I understand the concept around which it's based. I think it's certainly possible. What I'm seeing, you mentioned something that, you know, it's a little bit of a loose thread there that I think is getting a lot of attention. Depending on the company you work with, there's tremendous latitude in working remotely. Other companies are taking a totally different tack, and how that breaks out in the next several weeks and months, I think will probably create some interesting challenges for companies. It keeps coming back to, you know, we talked before, you and I, and this whole thing of culture. Boy, talk about the ultimate litmus test for your culture. The pandemic has been an incredible, I'll use the term you use for your sojourns out into the, this has been an incredible crucible. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see which companies emerged stronger and which companies are going to come limping out, potentially never to recover, by how they dealt with their employees, how they responded to their employees, how they helped employees get through it individually. You said something when we talked before, there are a lot of people that are right now maybe close to being on the edge. I think you're probably right. I think we're all so darn tired of this thing that there is a real risk. And for certain organizations, we're going to see the ramifications in 2021, even when we do get, if we get an effective vaccine.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because most of my work is executive coaching. And one of the first questions I start with people when I start working with them is, what do you want? And that's always a hard question. Now it seems harder than ever. Some of the parts about the pandemic, people have, you know, there's been a good part, you know, a lot of people have, like, I'm not on a plane. I'm having dinner with my family every night. That's been really nice. I don't want to go back to not having that same family time.
Right.
At the same time, people are getting recruited, and they're hearing things like, hey, you can work wherever you want. And they're saying, well, I know the job's in Houston, and I know they might say that, but if I'm going to get promoted, I'm going to have to move to Houston. Or I'm going to have to live on an airplane. And so I think that's the other thing that's going to be interesting is there's this whole push where, hey, I can live wherever I want. But then there's this powerful dynamic that happens with proximity. Mm-hmm. You know, I think back to the day, you know, you and I worked together and I was in the home office. I mean, the camaraderie and was just unparalleled. I mean, I couldn't have had that experience that I had that got me ready for other roles. I wouldn't have understood the politics. There's so many things I wouldn't have been effective if I didn't have close proximity to people and see the quirks and all these, you know, these different observations. So I think it's going to be really interesting. You know, the people that say, hey, I'm going to put a limit on things. I like this sort of environment. I think they're going to have to accept limitations on their advancement.
Yeah, I think you probably, you know, the brick and mortar mentality, which is what you're talking about, we will let go grudgingly. It will be different, but the decisions made around, if I take a job and the corporate headquarters are in Houston and I'm in Salt Lake City, how much of a downside? And there will be. I don't care what people say, there will be a downside. Maybe for certain companies that are out there on the edge in terms of progressive thinking, there won't be. But I this whole thinking about talent acquisition, think about how this is going to play out in 2021. There are a lot of talented people that are either on the street or are looking around right now and asking themselves, what's the culture I want to be a part of? What did I learn from this? And how am I going to apply it? And what kind of culture is going to give me the best opportunity to use those skills. You know, I keep going back to, there was a famous quote by Peter Drucker who said once that culture eats strategy for breakfast. Well, first of all, that's apocryphal. He never said it. But if he had said it, I think if we've learned anything, culture and strategy are both children of the same parent, and you can't separate one from the other. Culture and strategy are linked. The companies that have a culture that embraces strategy and the companies that look at culture as being a part of strategy are the ones that are ultimately the most successful.
Yeah. Well, let's, you know, before we go, let's talk about if we've got some recommendations, and I'll kind of start based on what you just said. You know, culture, strategy. You know, one of my big observations when I look at organizations from sort of a system perspective, you know, again, we can look at people and figure out how we manage and interface and influence them the best we can. But I think as an organizational level, we need to look at the big levers. You know, what's the structure? What are the processes, the things that speed up decisions? What are the incentives? Not money, but what incents people to do things or de-incents people to do other things? And then, you know, the whole idea of people, those big levers. And a lot of that boils down to really two things that we can be very intentional about on a daily basis. And that is the way that we meet. I mean, that there's a structure, there's a process, there's standards, there's etiquette for the way that we meet, what we accomplish in meetings, what the meetings are about, what the frequency or the cadence or rhythm are for those meetings. And a lot of them are decision-making meetings. And are we clear about who has the authority to make the decision, what the process is by which we will make it, and the criteria used to evaluate good decisions versus poor decisions? I think that is so loosey-goosey right now, the way that we meet. And I see it all the time. There'll be a Zoom meeting with 100 people on, and it'll be an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And here's what everybody's doing half the time.
Yeah.
They're totally disengaged. You know, I found that even the workshops that I do, I'll divide groups into two just to keep them small and lots of interactive, lots of breaks, keep them short, but being really intentional. And you know, the other thing I go back to what I learned from you as leaders, and this is what I think is probably the most important thing that gets set to the side, is when I get off the call with Tim Cole today, how do I want Tim to feel about himself? That's what you did. You were always intentional. I don't even know if it was conscious or not, but you were always intentional that when you left people, that they would feel that they could accomplish anything. And they weren't working for you and doing it for you. They were doing it with you and because of you and because they wanted a better life for themselves and they wanted to not let the team down. But again, I think that really takes, you know, some discipline to basically say, you know, I let me put my own pride and ego aside. How do I want to make people feel? And that takes a little bit of time and effort. So anyway, that's my thinking going into 2021. Again, meetings and decisions and how you make people feel.
Well, first of all, thank you. I appreciate the comment. As you were saying that, I'd like to think that was intentional. It was probably dumb luck and on my case, but I was reminded of a story. I had a good friend that was a Division I basketball player. I haven't seen him in years, but I used to play tennis with him on Monday nights. This was 15, 20 years ago. We were out playing, and it was an indoor event, and we would always sit down after, and somebody would bring refreshments, and we would talk about life. And on that particular night, this guy, his first name was Jed, said, "Well, I can't stay tonight. I've got to make phone calls." And we said, "Well, what do you got to do?" He said, "Well, I got a phone call from," and he mentioned the basketball coach, who is a guy by the name of Dean Smith, who most people know. Dean Smith was a phenomenal leader, but he had called our friend because he had another former player that was moving to the city that we lived in. And he said to Jed in so many words, "I told whoever that player's name was that you would help him find a job. Will you do that?" And Jed, who was in a totally different industry, said to us, "I'm going to find him a job. And I'm going to find him a job because the coach believes in me. And there is nothing more difficult for me to do than to call Coach Smith back and say, well, I couldn't do it. I can't let him down. And I thought about that after, Jed, and this guy was probably 51, 52 years old at the time, but I was looking in the eyes of an 18-year-old walk-on D1 potential player who looked at that leader and said, even though it's been 3-4 decades after, I'm going to find a way because I know he believes in me. And because of that, I believe in me. And so that's what I think great leaders do. And so that story came to mind. But I will also say the other thing that you said that's so very powerful, if we could get every potential client or would-be client to do an after-action review on 2020, to do exactly what you said, what did we learn from this and what are we going to do differently, then I think some of the things that you just described would become automatic. And in my case, I know that one of the things we're looking at, you mentioned some of those processes. I usually fall back on the 7S, you know, strategy, structure, systems, and then I will advance to skills and staff and style, all those other things. But I think that particularly as regards strategy, how we approach this, what we do differently to make sure that we've learned from this, and it bleeds into how we strategically think, how we strategically plan, and then finally how we strategically execute, will probably be a difference maker for a lot of the companies that I work with. Going back, you know, it's Einstein, doing the same things again and again, expecting a different result. That's the definition of insanity. Some smart companies are going to take this and they're going to apply it and they'll use it as a differential advantage. And there are a lot of companies that will try to go back to a normal that will no longer exist.
Yeah. Well, I like what you said before, Tim, you know, kind of a medical approach that there's analysis, there's diagnosis, there's treatment. But a lot, I mean, the thread in everything you've said is to take a step back. We're coming up on to 2 weeks at the end of the year. And I've been asking a lot of my clients, are you taking 2 weeks off here? And most of them said, I'm going to try really hard to take some time and be with the family and reflect and figure out what next year is. We just got a question from James Fung, and I'll read it out loud. Jan, Tim, thank you for your work. How do you see the typical organization structure evolve? There's a departure from traditional chains of authority, and it's become more natural for employees to speak directly to the top, which can render the middle management less effective. Do you see this dynamic, and how can the management structure be better organized to be effective for the workforce now and into the future? It's a good question. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, well, I'm going to say that I don't see a lot of functional structural changes with the clients that I work directly with. But I will say that there is a tendency in certain companies to look closely at a bit more decentralization, which is, I think, the essence of James' question. The challenge with that, so I agree, I think James is right, is headcount drops, the chances of making companies leaner is very, very strong. The challenge associated with that is if I'm a middle manager and I have, for discussion's sake, 10 direct reports, but half my peers have been eliminated and we go to 20, the thing I always look at is, okay, what is that going to do to those things like coaching and employee development? In my mind, the larger question, and I think the core of James' question is, will we be able to get to the point where there's a lot more communication between senior leadership and people that are maybe on the front lines? And I will tell you, I think that's happening even without those structural changes. A lot of organizations are realizing, you know, a classic example, strategy. The greatest driver for strategy is the constant generation of insights. The people that are able to first develop those insights are the people that are, in most cases, in our industry, the industries that I primarily work with, are the people that are right in front of the customer every day. So if you get them involved and you get that communication two-way going, I think you, whether there's a structural change or not, you get a lot more of a robust organization. And I think I appreciate the question from James. I think it's a very, very quality question to consider. Do we have communication that really makes a difference in the organization?
Yeah. Well, I'll reflect. When I was CEO, I loved, you know, talking to the people on the front lines, but it also made the people in the middle nervous because they knew if Jan was talking to somebody, then I was going to bring up, you know, an opportunity or a problem or an issue. And it I know what it made middle management feel like was they were sort of being cut off at the pass. And so I think if, you know, the CEO has to be very cognizant of trust and how it's fostered in the organization. And I reflect back on that time and I made a lot of mistakes. So I think, you know, again, if we go back to Lencioni's five dysfunctions of a team, you've got to really make sure you've got trust throughout the organization. And, you know, that all the intentions are for the good of the organization and that people are setting aside egos and different things. But yeah. It has to be, you have to really help people in the middle understand what you're doing, why you're doing it, how you're going to do it, and how you're going to circle back to them.
I think that's powerful. I agree with you. You know, and trust is the most difficult commodity, and it's not really a commodity, but it's the most difficult thing to build in organizations because, unfortunately, it always has to be a reciprocal arrangement. You don't get it unless you give it and vice versa.
Yeah. Well, Tim, we're kind of at the end of our time together. Any parting thoughts? Again, as we look at 2020, we look at 2021, you know, none of us had this in our plans. You know, I'm a big, huge planner. I plan my year out way in advance. And so this has thrown me for a major loop, all the things that I wanted to do. And even going into 2021, I've got all these things on my calendar, but I know they're just placeholders. I mean, who knows if I'm going to be able to do them or not. And so, you know, as we said in the military, you got to keep your knees bent, you know, so that when you're parachuting and you hit the ground, you don't break your legs. I feel like that's what we're doing right now. You're kind of keeping our knees bent.
I think that's, you know, I would say experience can be a great teacher. Adversity can be a wonderful instructor, depending on how we respond to it. I personally believe that there will be people that will take this crisis. They will pull from it lessons that they'll be able to apply to the future, and they'll be far more productive. And there will be a like number of people that simply survive it. And Jan, I know I've said this before. I've learned over the years that one of the most overrated attributes is experience, because cumulative years of existence doesn't mean anything. You could be 25 years, but it's really 1 year multiplied by 25. The people that take this and say, how will this make me better? I think we'll thrive in the future. And someday, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when we look back on this, we'll see this was an inflection point, and it created, in some cases, a new generation of leaders that will be far better equipped than the generation that preceded them.
Yeah. Well said, Tim. And how can people reach you?
The best way is by visiting my website, thecompassalliance.com, or reaching out to Tim Cole at thecompassalliance.com. Either of those, always happy to talk to friends and new friends. And Jan, you mentioned it before. What people need to know is that whatever limited skills I had, one of them was I could see talent. And I saw talent a long, long, long time ago. And I found if I can associate myself with talent, it makes up for a lot of my faults. And for the benefit of the viewing audience, one of the people that always came to mind was this guy named Rutherford, who was an ex-Green Beret. So don't buy into everything he's telling you about me. Recognize I find a way sometimes to get great people around me.
You just wanted the challenge of turning a country bumpkin into something socially acceptable.
You're speaking to a country bumpkin, so it's hard for me to recognize that person.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Tim. It's always a pleasure. And, as far as I encourage you to go out to the Compass Alliance, and then on my side, you know, on LinkedIn, we've got a bunch of courses out there. One of them is really sort of hit a stride this year. It's called Managing in Difficult Times. So I'd encourage you to look at that one. And again, if you've got any feedback for us, that would be great. And we've got some other great guests coming up in the new year. So tune in then. And in the meantime, happy holidays to everyone.
Thank you, Jan.